2014. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Paul Runyon. And tonight we will review the 2008 book, The Music of Pythagoras, by musicologist Kitty Ferguson. Now, this is a wonderfully erudite and deeply meaningful book on the accomplishments and lasting influence of the most important of the pre-Socratian philosophers, and perhaps the most important ancient avatar of our Western esoteric tradition. Now, as a musicologist, Ferguson is able to fully expound on the master's development of the music of the spheres. From a mythical Orpheus through the fledgling science of Kepler to close encounters of the third kind. And I said we can all whistle that one. The Pythagorean harmonious universe of music, mathematics, and geometry has been revalidated in modern times with the advent of new theories in quantum physics. It was, of course, the bedrock of the Kabbalah, of alchemy, and magic. We'll demonstrate some applications of the Pythagorean magical scale used to activate psychic centers, otherwise known as chakras, and discuss the employment of these techniques in magical operations. So, tune in, tune up, and we'll sing along with the planets. Let's sing along with the planet here. System, which is also located in the region of the third eye. And the sound was created on a crystal bowl made from the star mineral moldavite, an ancient meteorite that came down in Eastern Europe and has been linked to the Holy Grail by the Parseval. Now, that sound was an A note and is perfectly delineated in that particular configuration by Johannes Kepler in his almost modern rearrangement of the old original Pythagorean scale of the music of the spheres. Now, we'll get into more of that, and you'll hear more of the music of the spheres as we go along. But let's talk about Madam Ferguson's magisterial work here, The Music of Pythagoras. On the cover, she has a log line on the cover here. It says, how an ancient brotherhood cracked the code of the universe and lit the path from antiquity to outer space. Well, I'll read the dust flap here. The enthralling story of Pythagoras and the Pythagoreans, whose insights transformed the ancient world and still inspire the realms of science, mathematics, philosophy, and the arts. Pythagoras' influence on the ideas and therefore on the destiny of the human race was probably greater than that of any single man before or after him. So wrote Arthur Koestler. But most people know of him only for the famous Pythagorean theorem. That's a squared plus b squared equals c squared. In fact, the pillars of our scientific tradition, belief that the universe is rational, that there is a unity to all things, and that numbers and mathematics are a powerful guide to truth about nature and the cosmos, hark back to the thinking of this legendary scholar and his ancient followers. Born around 570 BC on the Aegean island of Samos, and Sir Alexandria spent some time on Samos, so we have a Samosian here then, Pythagoras' homeland, who's sitting here smiling at me. Pythagoras founded his own school at Croton in southern Italy, that's also called Crotona, where he and his followers attempted to unravel the surprising truths concealed behind such ordinary tasks as tuning a lyre, while considering why some of the string lengths produce beautiful sounds and others discordant ones. And they uncovered the ratios of musical harmony and recognized that hidden behind the complexity of nature are patterns and ordinary relationships. Some of them later may have found something darker in numbers and nature, irrationality, a revelation so unsettling and subversive that it may have contributed to the destruction of their brotherhood. Kenny Ferguson brilliantly evokes the ancient world of Pythagoras, showing the way ideas spread. In antiquity and in the Middle Ages, and chronicling the remarkable influence Pythagoras and his followers have had on so many notable people, from Plato to Bertrand Russell. And events in the history of Western thought and science, the music of Pythagoras brings a poignant human saga to readers who are reminded daily that harmony and chaos can and do exist. Now, Kitty Ferguson was the author of Tycho and Kepler, Measuring the Universe, The Fire of the Equations, Prisons of Light, and Stephen Hawking, Quest for a Theory of Everything. She is also a Juilliard-trained professional musician, and she lives in western New Jersey. And she is a very, very attractive-looking female, and with a prodigious intellect and a marvelous grasp on this subject. Now let's talk about how Mr. Ferguson approaches this almost legendary figure of Pythagoras. We know he existed, and yet, as she is very quick to point out, because she's a scholar and she doesn't want to give you the impression that everything she's saying about Pythagoras is absolutely factual, because we have the problem here is, and she points out, that Pythagoras, if Pythagoras wrote anything down, possibly he didn't, if he wrote anything down, none of what he wrote has survived, and virtually all of our knowledge of him comes from a few comments that have been written down by his contemporaries, just short comments. But then the three biographies of him were written several hundred years later. In fact, after the time of Christ, actually, by Porphyry, Amicus, and one other one. That they and all of these biographies, although they agree on the man's greatness and the basic principles of his teachings and pretty much what he accomplished, there's enough dissimilarity in these biographies to indicate that We really don't know point by point how his life unfolded. We have to wonder whether Propertius is right or Iamblichus is right or whatever. And yet we must assume that these Neoplatonic philosophers in their own right, that they had access to sources that we no longer have, and so we are left with a few paradoxes about Pythagoras, but for the most part, there's enough in the biographies that exist to where we can piece together the main stories, the man's life. So let's start off by saying that he was born on the island of Samos, or if possibly born in Sidon in Phoenicia, but he was essentially a Samosian. He was a Greek. Well, we would say that he was a Greek citizen. Okay, but his mother was Phoenician, and his father was a Greek merchant, a very successful Greek merchant, who was also his father's hobby was jewel engraving, and along with being a very successful merchant. Now, Samos, an island in the Aegean, which, as I say, Zondra has been there and actually spent some time there, it's the magical island that Shakespeare had in mind when he created The Tempest. And I wish I could get Zondra to tell us something about Samos. She don't want to do it. She said, I don't want to come talk about it. And but it's a very steep island. There's high mountains, and it even has like Maui out in Hawaii. It gets kind of alpine up in the higher reaches of its mountainous area, and it's very forested, or at least it was, and it. It really was the ideal island for Prospero in Shakespeare's The Tempest, the magical island. So this is where Pythagoras grew up. By the way, the name Pythagoras means adorer of the Pythia, because when he was a little child, he was taken to the Oracle of Delphi. And, of course, according to the legend, she predicted that he would be one of the great world teachers. And so his father named him, or he acquired the name of Pythagoras, adorer of the Pythia, and the Pythia being the oracle, the prophetess. And so when he was a precocious teenager, his father, being a merchant and a sailor, and being, certainly... Now, Porphyry, who was a Neoplatonist and followed a student of Iamblichus, Porphyry actually put forth the idea that Pythagoras really was a Phoenician. And this... It's possible, but certainly he had a very strong connection with the Phoenicians through his mother, and the fact that his father had business connections, obviously, with the Phoenicians and their sailors. And so our friend Karim El-Kusa has written his own book on Pythagoras called Pythagoras the Mathematician, which I must admit I haven't read yet, but Karim, I will catch up and I will read that book definitely. But obviously Karim is being an ardent Phoenician. He's going to take the Porphyry at his word and say Pythagoras was a Phoenician. Well, now, actually, there's a good argument for this in the fact that Pythagoras did amend his world travels, at least in part of the world he could reach. He did spend some time in Phoenicia studying the Phoenician prophets and the temple at Melkart, which I don't believe Alexander had torn it down by that time, at that time. But no, it was before Alexander tore it down. So the temple of Melkart in Tyre, and Melkart, by the way, was Hercules, the Phoenicians. Melkart, lord of the city, was the first Hercules. And so we have basically the big secret inside the temple was the labors of Hercules going around the zodiac. And here is little Pythagoras studying there, and then going to Mount Carmel, and then going to, into Phoenicia. And studying, now, Josephus thought that he was studying Jewish philosophy, but probably wasn't. This is probably Phoenician prophets. That's Enoch and Enoch and perhaps Melchizedek and those that the L group, because most of the Palestinians were at that time devotees of El. So this definitely, now, I want to point out, because you're going to get into it later on a little bit, that there is a definite connection with the Melkart Phoenician Hercules and his labors. There's a definite connection to the Orphic theology, the mysterious Orphic theology that Pythagoras adopted. And this was a strange cult in Greece. It came down from above the Black Sea, possibly of Scythian origin, maybe even further back of Central Asian origin, that worshipped the stars and worshipped the planets and thought that the Milky Way was the river of souls, and believed in reincarnation and all of the various things that are indicated by the labors of Hercules. And this, of course, was something that Pythagoras very, very much related to and promoted, and gave a very beautiful, profound philosophical structure to this myth, this Orphic myth. Now, however, Pythagoras didn't just go to Phoenicia and pick that up, and then go back and get with the Orphics and start off. Before he did that, he spent a couple of years in Babylon learning Chaldean astrology, Babylonian astrology, and then he went over to Egypt and he had a problem with the Egyptian priests. They kept passing him off from one temple to another, and of course he couldn't have a problem learning Egyptian, but he finally managed to get there to get their division of the soul and their concepts under his intellectual belt. And then he set out for his eventual home, Cortone or Cortona in Italy. Now, Cortona was, and the modern version of it still is, right down there on the instep of the Italian boot, right across the Adriatic. Now, at that time, Rome was just getting started, and they were up there. The Romans were up there on a big building program, having a grand expense. But that, the southern part of Italy and Sicily, was mostly Greek. And you shouldn't actually call these Greek colonies, because they weren't really colonies. They were part of what was known as Greater Greece. In other words, they were right across the Adriatic from Greece, and so Crotona was a Greek city, very sophisticated. And this was, this was the age of 550 BC. This was the age when the Greeks were just beginning to have their philosophical flowering. And, of course, the Golden Age came a few hundred years later with Plato and Aristotle. But this is where with Pythagoras and his contemporaries, Empedocles and Parmenides, and these were the pre-Socratian philosophers. That's what they're referred to as. And Socrates, of course, was the direct mentor of Plato. Okay. However, the secret mentor of Plato, and this has become more and more obvious in as time goes on, was Pythagoras. Plato was a closet Pythagorean. Now, let's talk about just a little bit about what Pythagoras's what was his religion, and how did he come by it, and then we could see where he used philosophy and reason, intellect and logic, to take that very mysterious, very, very ecstatic, Orphic cosmology and turn it into a vision of the universe, a virtually scientific vision of the universe out of this incredible myth. Now, here's what the Orphic cult, which, as I say, it was not originally native to Greece. It isn't something that the Achaeans came up with or anything like that. This was some kind of an import from north of the Black Sea, and as some people have suggested, it may have come down from Central Asia. And one of the reasons why they think that is because of the fact that it has these shamanic aspects to it, which we could attribute to Amanita if we wanted to. And it has these shamanic aspects, and these Dionysian aspects to it, the women going crazy, running around in the nude, catching little animals and eating them raw. That's pretty wild. But this is shamanic and seems to have, especially because it's north polar, it has that north polar, North Star, Hyperborean, mysterious mill of the stellar universe aspect to it. It carries that with it. And what these Orphics believed was that they believed absolutely in reincarnation, which, of course, the Egyptians didn't. And the Jews didn't, and the Babylonians didn't, but the Orphics did. And they believed in reincarnation, which, of course, fits in with the labors of Hercules, by the way. But they believed that the human soul came from the stars and returned to the stars. And they believed the human soul at death rode up the river of the Milky Way, which was the river of souls, and circled around the circumpolar vortex, and then came back down through the gate of men, which was traditionally Cancer, and then was reincarnated in Leo, and then went around and went down through the planetary spheres, acquiring the attributes and the faults of each of these planetary spheres and the gods that rule them on the way down to be reborn. Now, this is not all of it. It's more complex than that. And there is a loss of memory at drinking at the River Lethe, and all these various things. This, by the way, this belief generated some marvelous poetry. These Orphics were buried with these amulets that had these these beautiful poems of how to ascend the River of the Stars, and how to meet the guardians, and how to, and, you know, and you can see here, this is not only the origin of Pythagorean. This is the Pythagorean challenge to build a structure for this, to take this vision of the universe and make it work philosophically, mathematically, geometrically, astrologically. In other words, this is the origin. This is the origin of what we call the Hermetic tradition. Goes back to Pythagoras and to what Pythagoras learned in ancient Egypt, and of course also Egyptian concepts of the soul. And this is what we have to look at here is this remarkable myth that this philosopher is determined to reify. He's going to make this real. He's going to give his followers access to this. And he was an aesthetic. He was very, very moral, but his morality was based upon the idea of purifying the soul so that you could rise on the planes. And this, when we talk about this Orphic myth, the character of Orpheus was kind of almost a later addition to this, but in order to make the myth a bit more personified, the character of Orpheus, who was created, the mythical character of Orpheus, sort of a tragic hero, and he was a great singer and a great musician, and his instrument was the lyre. And so he played the lyre, and of course I think we've all heard the myth of Orpheus, where he goes down into the underworld to save his love Eurydice, and he can bring her back, but then he turns around and looks at her and loses her, and that was the tragedy of Orpheus. Jean Cocteau made a wonderful symbolic movie out of that, by the way, that we run occasionally on holidays. We will run Cocteau's Orpheus. Beautiful film. But Pythagoras took this, as we read in the book jacket. Pythagoras took the strings and the notes of Orpheus's lyre, and started to analyze them in relation to the music of the spheres. The spheres being the scheme of the heavens. Now, they used to think of the planets in the old days. Of course, they were geocentric, as you know. And they used to think of the planets as being in fixed spheres, like glass globes, one outside the other, outside the other, outside the other. And so the planets were on these spheres, and the spheres revolved. And that's where we get the expression, the music of the spheres. Now, Pythagoras, as we know, was very, very interested in mathematics in relation to just about everything in the universe. He thought that everything in the universe had some mathematical formula that could be attributed to it. And this was, of course, a revolutionary idea. And along with this, he became fascinated with these musical notes and how they would apply to the spheres themselves, the planetary spheres, and the sphere beyond, on the idea of the spirit descending through the spheres. Now, Because of that, and because they had a geocentric universe they were dealing with at that time, because of that, Pythagoras and his followers tended to think that the furthest out planet they could see was Saturn, of course. And they thought that Saturn was moving very slowly. It was moving very slowly, but they thought it was moving fast. And the reason why they thought it was moving fast is because of the fact that it was fixed out there and the Earth was revolving. So they got this mistaken idea, or at least from their perspective, so it wasn't really mistaken. From their perspective, the furthest out planet they could see, Saturn, was moving faster. And Jupiter was moving a little slower. And so all the way down to the moon, which they thought was moving, moving the slowest. So they created their scale, which brought down the emanations. They created a scale based upon the highest speed being attributed to Saturn, being attributed to the fixed stars, and then which was the sphere beyond Saturn, and then the next sphere was Saturn, and then on down. Now, in order to develop this, they invented a device. Actually, it's kind of a musical instrument called a monochord. Now, this makes, by the way, a great scientific high school science project. Now, Fred Adams and I, Fred Adams primarily, and I helped him a little bit. We made several monochords and we experimented with them. And the way you do this is you get yourself a nice straight 4x4 post and, cut it off about, you can make them any length you want, but we had about 5 feet, and cut them off about 5 feet. And then you put a block about, maybe an inch high on one end, and then another block an inch high on the other end, and you stretch a piano wire very tightly across those blocks and nail them down on either end, and then you have them crossing the blocks. And what you've got here is, and you screw them in real tight, and what you have here is a one-chord instrument. No sound box, unless you want to put one in. I suppose you could put a sound box in there. But, you got a one-chord guitar with no sound box. And then what you do is you create a floating bridge. Now, the floating bridge is just a piece of wood, a triangular piece of wood. But these triangular rulers make wooden rulers, the old triangular wooden rulers. They make real good floating bridges for your monochord. And that reason is that you got something you can slide, but you also have a point there that you can dampen. Now, the way you work this and the way the Pythagoreans experimented with this is that they would take this and they would start these ratios. And the first one they had, they divide the face of the plank or the stud into the half, and so they knew what the exact half of it was, and they put the bridge right on that half, and they damped the bridge with their hand or fingers or whatever, and then they would pluck the cord, and they would get a note, and then they would take. And they would take half of what they had. They would cut that in half, and then they would move the bridge down to the half of what they had just plucked, and they would damp that down, and they damp both of them down, and then they would pluck that, and that would be the next note. Now, so they have a half. They have a they have a half of what they had before, and then they would keep having this this cord, and you keep having it all the way down, and that was their original idea of how to develop the sound pattern for the spheres, for the planetary spheres. Now, they actually thought that the planets were in some kind of air and actually were making a sound. Well, of course, we know now today, of course, planets do make sounds. Of course, Jupiter tends to overwhelm all of them. So if you want to, you know, for quite a while, of course, during the age of so-called enlightenment, people were poo-pooing that idea. Oh, planets don't make sounds. There's nothing out there, and you know, and whatever. But this was what Pythagoras thought, that everything, he thought that everything had some sort of a vibration or sound to it. And so he was going to create this battery of sound so that they could mystically attune themselves to the universe itself. Remember now that Hermes, under the obviously the influence of the Pythagoreans, came up with the idea that the universe, that man is a miniature of the universe, and so this had a great deal to do with starting off that idea. And so what we have here is a series of ratios. Now, Kitty Ferguson points out in her book, this process got refined through all the way up through the Middle Ages. People were working on it, and because obviously the monochord halving these things each time didn't produce really usable intervals, and it was a concept, it was an idea, but it didn't really work. So this kept going, and people kept trying to do it, and finally, in the later part of the Renaissance, Johannes Kepler, the astronomer, he came up with and Kitty has it here in the book. She actually has the keyboard laid out with Kepler's version of it. Now, Kepler, of course, was a Copernican. In other words, he was a follower of Copernicus, and he knew that the universe didn't revolve around the Earth. But he still was an ardent Pythagorean, and he took upon the task to take Pythagoras' Music of the Spheres and make it work with modern tonalities and still understanding, and Kepler did, he understood that Pythagoras thought that Saturn was very fast and a high note and fast, and the moon was down the bottom and slow and a low note. And he knew that was wrong. But then he, in deference to Pythagoras, he allowed that to continue, and produced a usable modern Pythagorean Music of the Spheres battery here, which goes down from the fixed stars, Saturn, Jupiter, Mars, Sun, Venus, Mercury, Moon, and of course to that we naturally add the Earth, because we want to be able to ground it with the Earth. And so this, I'm going to play this for you. I have it on the synthesizer here, so you can hear this. You can hear what Kepler came up with, which just happens to line up with that wonderful Moldavite singing bowl that we opened up with, which, by the way, is attuned to opening the third eye, and that, of course, is Jupiter, and that's just said in the Western system, and that hits right on the note. So, and we'll try, we'll experiment using the bowl and the synthesizer notes at the same, and I'll show you how that works. But this, starting up here at the top with the thick stars and moving down, this is the music of the spheres. The note that we just played for Jupiter, I said, and we're going to play that along with the bowl, and we'll see what we can harmonize with here. Now, this, of course, is one of the most useful and empowering aspects of meditation, is to be able to do this and to use these notes and singing bowls and tuning forks, you know, in order to enhance and to activate the planets within, as Pacino liked to call them. And the relationship here between, you may be asking, well, what about the old Hindu chakra system, you know, and whatever. Well, actually, even though it took all the way up to Joseph Brohm in Germany in about 1700 to actually put the planets on the human body and get the Western system working after Pythagoras had years and years before had envisioned it and gotten it started. One of the reasons why this was is because the Kabbalah had not been integrated completely into the Hermetic Rosicrucian system yet. It took all the way up to 1700 to get the German Brohm and then his disciple Johann Gichel to finally put this original Pythagorean scheme into use. Somehow or other, the Hindu system doesn't use the planets, although they have, as a later correspondence, they did. They didn't bring, they weren't that influenced by this Orphic tradition. They did not bring the celestial power down from above through the spheres the way the Pythagoreans and the Hermetic people did. So consequently, their system is somewhat different. They bring power up from the earth, and they breathe it in with pranayama. Now, certainly pranayama is very important, and it does work. But it's very possible that although we don't have too much evidence of Pythagoras getting into pranayama, and yet we do have some Hermetic aspects where we apply the sun and the moon to the different parts of the head. So it's possible that and the Greeks did the aspirate of breathing was important to the ancient Greeks. So consequently, our system is, even though it took all the way up to the 1700s to get it, but then, you know, from what I understand, the The Hindu chakra system really didn't get started until about 1500 AD anyway, and so they didn't get too far ahead of us. And the impact of Pythagoras in other areas, and this of course is the part that applies to us, is what we've been dealing with now. But Kitty Ferguson really, really shows how this idea of a universe that you really can understand the laws and the rules of why it does what it does, why it, you know, Empedocles said everything is air, earth, fire, water, love, and strife. But then Pythagoras came and says, "Well, yeah. Well, if that's the case, let's figure out how to what makes love run and what makes strife happen and what are the numerical equivalents of this? How do we engineer air, earth, fire, water, love, and strife and make it work?" Now, you know, the putting aside of Pythagoras occurred primarily because he was very, very influential all the way up through the Renaissance. He didn't get put aside until the Age of Enlightenment, when you know, we had everything had to be scientifically validated, otherwise it was just an imagination. But now, in the past 30, 40 years, we are beginning to look at Pythagoras's ideas and his schemes and realize that yes, he did. The universe is this way. It may not be exactly the way he, but he was on the right track. He had the right concept. And yes, vibration and harmony, and like I said, in the abstract, you know, we're all familiar with the Close Encounters of the Third Kind, that little tune they played in variations to communicate with the aliens. And you remember all the different variations of that? The idea here was that if music is universal, and if we don't know their language and they don't know ours, let's communicate with music. And Pythagoras would have, the ghost of Pythagoras was probably smiling and whistling along with them, because this is what he had been saying, you know, 2,500 years ago. And so, in many, many ways, this is a new Pythagorean age. But the debt that we owe to him is incalculable. This man was an incredible master, and his school, you know, was revered. Plato, by the way, as I think I maybe mentioned, Plato went over to Crotona and stayed there for years, just trying, and that was a couple hundred years after Pythagoras, trying to learn as much as he could about Pythagoras. He was an ardent and still somewhat secretive Pythagorean. The Timaeus, Plato's Timaeus, is virtually all Pythagorean. And as Gershom Scholem, the great Kabbalistic scholar, said, the Kabbalah of the Middle Ages, and especially the Sefer Yetzirah, which comes out around 300 A.D., is definitely Pythagorean. And so, you know, the structure of the Kabbalah is, Fred Adams took a Pythagorean Tetrakis and he bisected and trisected it and came up with a grid off of this that all different versions, authentic versions of the Tree of Life have to fit on that grid. So the tree of life structure is Pythagorean. And I think Leonora Lee would probably admit to this also. So the influence of Pythagoras drawing upon the Phoenician traditions, the Orphic traditions, he had a tremendous influence on Gnosticism, on Christianity, if thrice greatest Hermes is three people, then Pythagoras is certainly one of them. So this is something that I think we all should really study is this. And I was absolutely fascinated with Ms. Ferguson's book, and I strongly recommend it to everyone, you know, that's interested in the Hermetic tradition, because the Hermetic tradition just exalts and nurtures Pythagorean wisdom. And now, next week, we're going to have a call-in night, which we haven't had in a while, and we're going to discuss these various aspects that we have been talking about, both in the Hermetic link and in the music of Pythagoras, and these various aspects of the Western tradition that we really should take seriously. And I want to leave you with this thought. One of the problems with modern Western occultism, and it is becomes more and more obvious the more you delve into it, is that modern occultists don't read the classics. They don't read books on Pythagoras. They don't read the Hermetic treatises. They don't read Macrobius. They don't read Plato's Timaeus. They don't read where our tradition really comes from. They spend a lot of time reading Blavatsky and Levy and Paul Case and I'm not going to say it's bad to read Rigardi, because Rigardi certainly had a better grasp on this classical material than some of the other people I've mentioned. But the problem with modern Western occultists is they don't get back to what really, really started the tradition off and what it's grounded in. And so next week we're going to discuss these classics, all of these classic works that you should read and that you should base your concepts on, rather than some of the ideas that have come down to us, from modern occultists who have their own slant on things. And so next week, let's hear from you. Let's hear from you, and let's get some good discussions going. Until then, and remember now, our call-in number for next week, we'll give it to you now. Our call-in number is 347-857-1830. That's 347-857-1830. So, get your questions ready, and we're going to talk, but let's try to stay on topic. We're going to talk about classical sources, classical and medieval and Renaissance source material for the Hermetic magical tradition. And so until next week, good magic, and